engine was running. Terry inhaled exhaust in long, chest-filling gulps. It tasted bad to begin with, but you got used to it pretty fast. "It's not too late to change your mind," Rita said, taking his hand. His wife sat beside him in the passenger seat. "You might still be able to take control out there, impose a little sanity." "Too late for that, hun," Terry said. The garage was now blue with toxic vapor. Terry took another deep breath, stifled a cough, and inhaled again. "I don't know how this is going to come out, but I see no good ending. This way is better." Rita squeezed his hand sympathetically. "I keep thinking of every mess on the highway I ever cleaned up," Terry said. "And that guy's head pushed right through the wall of that meth cooker's trailer." Dimly across the miles, from the direction of the prison, came the sound of explosions. Terry repeated, "This way is better," and closed his eyes. Although he knew he was alone in Unit 4, he could still feel his wife squeezing his hand as he drifted away from dueling and everything else. 10. Frank and Johnny Lee Kronsky were working their way between the wreckage of Barry Holden's RV and the wall of the prison. They were almost to the smashed main doors when they heard the second bazooka shell whistling toward them.
"Incoming!"
Kronsky shouted. Frank looked over his shoulder and saw an amazing thing. The bazooka shell struck the parking lot on its rear fin, bounced high without exploding, and dropped nose down toward the bulldozer that had been piloted by the late Jack Albertson. The roar of its detonation was deafening. The driver's seat was blown through the thin shell of the dozer's roof. Disintegrating treads rose in the air like steel piano keys, and one of the iron shields that had been placed to guard the cockpit doors shot outward, punching through the RV ahead of it like the peen of a giant's sledgehammer. Frank stumbled over the twisted base of one of the main doors, and thus his life was saved. Johnny Lee Kronsky, still upright, was not just decapitated by a flying wedge of the Fleetwood siding. He was cut in two at the shoulders. Yet he staggered on two or three more steps, his heart beating long enough to send two gaudy jets of blood into the air. Then he collapsed. The C4 football fell from his hands and wobbled toward the security station. It came to rest with the embedded Android phone visible, and Frank saw 149 become 148, become 147. He crawled toward it, blinking concrete dust out of his eyes, then rolled to one side and into the shelter of the half-collapsed reception desk, as Tig Murphy leaped up behind the security station's bulletproof glass and fired his sidearm through the slot where visitors were supposed to surrender their IDs and phones. The angle was bad, and Tig's slug went high. Frank was okay if he stayed down, but if he tried to go forward, toward the doors leading into the prison proper, he'd be a sitting duck. Going back, ditto. The lobby was filling with diesel smoke from the burning bulldozer. Added to this was the high, nauseating stench of Kronsky's spilled blood, gallons of it from the look. Beneath Frank was one of the reception desk's legs, its splintered end digging into his back between his shoulder blades. Lying just out of Frank's reach was the C4. 129 became 128, became 127.
"There's men all around the prison," Frank shouted. "Give up and you won't be hurt." "Suck shit! This is our prison! You're trespassing and you got no authority!"
Tig fired another shot.
"There's explosive! C4! It's gonna blow you to pieces!"
"Right, and I'm Luke fucking Skywalker!"
"Look out! Look down! You'll see it!"
"So you can try putting one in my gut through the slot? Think I'll pass."
Desperate, Frank looked around toward the doors he'd come through, partially blocked by the remains of the RV.
"You guys out there," he shouted. "I need some covering fire."
No covering fire came. No reinforcements, either. Two of the men, Steve Pickering and Will Whitstock, were in full retreat, carrying the wounded Roop Whitstock between them. On the littered floor of the lobby, almost at the base of the security station manned by Tig Murphy, The cell phone continued to count down toward zero. 11. Seeing Billy Weddermore undeniably dead made Don Peters feel a little better. Don had gone bowling with him once. The little princess had rolled a 252 and taken 20 bucks off Don. It was pretty obvious that he'd used some sort of doctored bowling ball, but Don had let it pass, the way he let so many things pass, because that was the kind of easygoing guy he was. Well, sometimes the world tilted the right way, and that was a fact. One less fag in the world, he thought, and we all say hooray. He hustled toward the gymnasium. Maybe I'll be the one to get her, he thought. Put a bullet right into Evie Black's quacking mouth and end this for good. They'd forget all about that mistake with Junior, and I wouldn't have to buy a drink down at the Squeak for the rest of my life. He stepped toward the door, already imagining Evie Black in his sights, but Elmore Pearl shoved him away.
Stand back, quick draw.
Hey, Don bleated. You don't know where you're going. He started forward again, but Drew T. Barry grabbed him and shook his head. Barry himself had no intention of being first inside, not when he didn't know what was waiting. Probably the one he'd shot had been their only rear guard, but if there was someone, Pearl had a better chance of knocking him down than Peters, whose only kill this morning had been one of their own. Pearl was looking over his shoulder at Don and grinning as he stepped into the gym.
Relax and let a man lead the...
That was as far as he got before Maura Dunbarton's cold hands gripped him, one by the neck and the other by the back of his head. Elmore Pearl gazed into those soulless eyes and began to screech. He didn't screech for long. The reanimated thing that had been Maura stuck her hand into his mouth, ignored his biting teeth, and yanked straight down. The sound of his upper and lower jaws parting company was like the sound of a drumstick being torn off a Thanksgiving turkey. 12.
Damn if we ain't a couple of lucky sons of bitches, Maynard Griner exulted. Any more distance and them shells would just explode in the parking lot. Did you see that last one bounce, Lo?
I saw it, Lo agreed. Skipped like a stone on a pond and took out a bulldozer. Not bad, but I can do better. Reload me.
Below, the prison was boiling smoke from the hole in the western wall. It was a glorious sight, reminiscent of the gush that came out of a mine when a blast went off, except much better, obviously, because they weren't cracking rocks. They were cracking a goddamn state facility. It would have been worth doing even if they hadn't needed to close Kitty McDavid's snitching mouth. May was reaching into the ammo bag when he heard a branch snap. He whirled, reaching for the gun stuffed into his belt at the small of his back. Van fired the pistol Fritz Mieschaum had tried to kill her with. The range was short, but she was exhausted, and instead of taking Maynard in the chest, the bullet only clipped his shoulder and sent him sprawling over the depleted bag of bazooka shells. His unfired gun fell into some bushes and caught by the trigger guard.
Brother! He shouted. Shot! She shot me!
Lo dropped the bazooka and snatched up the rifle lying beside him. With one of them out of commission, Van could afford to focus. She secured the butt of the pistol at the center of her considerable bosom and pulled the trigger. Little Lo's mouth exploded. His brains exited the back of his skull, and he aspirated his teeth with his final breath.
Lo! Maynard screamed. Brother!
He grabbed the gun hanging in the bushes, but before he could bring it to bear, his wrist was gripped by something more like an iron manacle than a human hand.
You should know better than to point a gun at an arm wrestling champ, even when she's been awake for a week, Van said in an oddly gentle voice, and twisted.
From inside May's wrist came a sound like breaking twigs. He shrieked. The gun dropped from his hand and she kicked it away.
You shot low, Maynard blubbered. Killed him.
So I did.
Van's head was ringing, her hip was throbbing. It felt like she was standing on a deck in rough waters. She was near the end of her considerable endurance, and she knew it. But this had been a sight more useful than killing herself, no doubt about that. Only now what? May had the same question, it seemed.
What are you going to do with me?
I can't tie him up, Van thought. I've got nothing to tie him up with. Am I just going to go to sleep and let him get away? Probably after he puts a few rounds in me while I'm growing my cocoon. She looked down at the prison, where a crushed RV and a blazing bulldozer blocked the main doors. She meditated on the hole the first bazooka shell had put in Sea Wing, where dozens of women had been sleeping, defenseless in their cocoons. How many had been killed by these two country-fried assholes? Which one are you, Lowell or Maynard?
Maynard, ma'am.
He tried on a smile. You the stupid one or the smart one, Maynard? His smile grew.
I'm the stupid one, no doubt. Failed out of school in the 8th grade. I just do whatever Lowell says.
Van returned the smile. Well, I guess I'll just let you go, Maynard. No harm and no foul. You've got a truck down there. I took a peek and the keys are in the ignition. Even driving one-handed, I think you could be most of the way to Pedro's south of the border by noon, if you don't spare the horses. So why don't you get going before I change my mind?
Thank you, ma'am.
May started jogging back among the tombstones of the little country graveyard. Van briefly considered following through on her promise, but the chances were fair to good that he'd double back and discover her sleeping beside his dead brother. Even if he didn't, they'd been laughing over their dirty ambush like boys throwing baseballs at wooden bottles during County Fair Week. She didn't dare let him get far, either, because she no longer trusted her aim. At least he won't know what hit him, she thought. Van raised Meeschaum's pistol and, not without regret, put a round in May's back.
Oof,
was his final word on Mother Earth as he tripped forward into a pile of dry leaves. Van sat down with her back against a leaning gravestone, so old the name once carved thereon was almost completely worn away, and closed her eyes. She felt bad about shooting a man from behind, but this feeling was quickly smothered beneath a rising wave of sleep. Oh, it felt so good to give in. Threads began to spin from her skin. They blew prettily back and forth in a morning breeze. It was going to be another beautiful day in mountain country. 13. The glass was supposed to be bulletproof, but two close-range shots from the M4 Willie was toting blew Clint's office window out of its frame. Clint hauled himself in and landed on his desk. It seemed to him that he had sat behind it writing reports and evaluations in another lifetime. He heard screams and shouting from the direction of the gymnasium, but that was nothing he could deal with now. He turned to assist Willie and saw the old man leaning against the building with his head lowered. His breathing was harsh and rapid. Willie raised his arms.
Hope you're strong enough to pull me in, Doc, because I ain't gonna be able to give you much help.
Give me your gun first. Willie handed up the M4. Clint put it on his desk with his own weapon, atop a stack of good report forms. Then he seized Willie's hands and pulled. The old man was able to help after all, pedaling his work shoes against the building below the window, and he practically flew in. Clint went over on his back. Willie landed on top of him.
This is what I call pretty goddamn intimate, Willie said.
His voice was strained and he looked worse than ever, but he was grinning.
In that case, you better call me Clint.
He got Willie to his feet, handed him the M4, and grabbed his own gun. Let's get our asses down to Evie's cell.
What are we going to do when we get there?
I have no idea, said Clint. 14. Drew T. Berry couldn't believe what he was seeing. Two women who looked like corpses, and Elmore Pearl with his mouth pulled into a yawning cavern. His lower jaw seemed to be lying on his chest. Pearl staggered away from the creature that held him. He made almost a dozen steps before Mora caught him by the sweat-soaked collar. She drew him against her and stuck a thumb deep into his right eye. There was a pop, like a cork coming out of a bottle. Viscous liquid spilled down Pearl's cheek, and he went limp. Kaylee turned jerkily toward Don Peters, like a wind-up toy with a tired spring. He knew he should run, but an incredible lassitude seemed to have filled him. "I have gone to sleep," he reasoned, "and this is the world's worst nightmare. Has to be, because that's Kaylee Rawlings. I put that bitch on bad report just last month. I'll let her get me, and that's when I'll wake up." Drew T. Barry, whose life's work involved imagining the worst things that could happen to people, never considered the old, "I must be dreaming" scenario. This was happening, even though it seemed like something straight out of that show where rotting dead people came back to life, and he had every intention of surviving it. "Duck!" he shouted. Don might not have done so if the plastic explosive hadn't detonated at that instant on the other side of the prison. It was actually more of a fall than a duck, but it did the job. Instead of grasping the soft meat of his face, Kaylee's pallid fingers slapped off the hard plastic shell of the football helmet. There was a gunshot, amplified to monstrous levels in the empty gymnasium, and a point-blank round from the Weatherby, a gun that could literally stop an elephant, did the job on Kaylee. Her throat simply exploded, and her head lolled back, all the way back. Her body crumpled. Mora cast Elmore aside and lurched toward Don, a boogie lady whose hands opened and snapped closed, opened and snapped closed.
"Shoot her!" Don screamed.
His bladder let go, and warm piddle coursed down his legs, soaking his socks. Drew T. Barry considered not doing it. Peters was an idiot, a loose cannon, and they might be better off without him. "Oh, well," he thought, "okay. But after this, Mr. Prison Guard, you're on your own." He shot Mora Dunbarton in the chest. She flew back to center court, landing beside the late Elmore Pearl. She lay there a moment, then struggled up and started toward Don again, although her top and bottom halves no longer seemed to be working together very well.
"Shoot her in the head!" Don screamed.
He seemed to have forgotten that he had a gun himself.
"Shoot her in the head like you did the other one!"
"Will you please just shut up?" said Drew T. Barry.
He sighted and blew a hole through Mora Dunbarton's head that vaporized the upper left quadrant of her skull.
"Oh, God!" Don gasped. "Oh, God! Oh, God! Oh, God! Let's get out of here! Let's go back to town!"
Little as Drew T. Barry liked the pudgy ex-guard, he understood Peters's impulse to run, even sympathized with it to a degree. But he had not become the most successful insurance man in the Tri-Counties by giving up on a job before it was finished. He grabbed Don by the arm.
"Drew, they were dead! What if there are more?"
"I don't see any more, do you?"
"But..."
"Lead the way. We're going to find the woman we came for."
And out of nowhere, a bit of Drew T. Barry's high school French recurred to him.
"Cherchez la femme."
"Churchy, what?"
"Never mind."
Drew T. Barry gestured with his high-powered rifle, not exactly at Don, but in his general vicinity.
"You go first. 30 feet ahead of me should be good."
"Why?"
"Because," Drew T. Barry said, "I believe in insurance."
15. While Vanessa Lampley was putting paid to Maynard Griner, and Elmore Pearl was undergoing impromptu oral surgery from the reanimated corpse of Mora Dunbarton, Frank Geary was beneath the half-collapsed reception desk, watching as 46 seconds became 45, became 44. There would be no help from outside, he knew that now. The remaining men out there were either hanging back or gone. If he was going to get past the goddamn security station and into the prison proper, he would have to do it on his own. The only alternative was to scurry back outside on his hands and knees and hope the guy behind the bulletproof glass didn't shoot him in the ass. He wished none of this had happened. He wished he was cruising one of the pleasant roads of Dueling County in his little truck, looking for someone's pet raccoon. If a domesticated coon was hungry, You could coax him close enough to use the net with a piece of cheese or hamburger on the end of the long pole Frank called his treat stick. That made him think of the shattered desk leg poked into his back. He rolled on his side, grabbed it, and pushed it along the floor. The leg was just long enough to reach the lethal football. Nice to finally catch a break.
"What are you doing?"
Tig asked from behind the glass. Frank didn't bother answering. If this didn't work, he was a dead man. He speared the football with the jagged end of the leg. Johnny Lee had assured him that even driving over the stuff wouldn't cause it to explode, and the stick didn't set it off. He lifted the desk leg and leaned it just below the window with its ID slot. 17 seconds became 16, became 15. Tig fired once, and Frank felt the bullet pass just above his knuckles.
"Whoever you are in there, you better get gone," he said. "Do it while you've got the chance."
Taking his own advice, Frank dove toward the front doors, expecting to take a bullet. But Tig never fired again. Tig was peering through the glass at the white football stuck on the end of the desk leg like a big piece of gum. He got his first good look at the phone, where 4 seconds became 3. He understood then what it was and what was going to happen. He bolted for the door giving on the prison's main corridor. His hand was on the knob when the world went white. 16. Outside the main doors, shadowed from the brightening sun by the remains of the Fleetwood RV, never to take Barry Holden and his family on camping expeditions again, Frank felt the badly mauled building shudder from the latest blast. Glass that had survived the earlier explosions thanks to reinforcing wire belched out in glittering shards.
"Come on," shouted Frank. "Any of you who are left, come on. We're taking her right now."
For a moment there was nothing. Then 4 men, Carson Struthers, Deputy Treat, Deputy Ordway, and Deputy Barrows, trotted from cover and ran to the blasted front doors of the prison. They joined Frank and disappeared into the smoke. 17.
"Holy fucking shit," Jared Norcross breathed.
Michaela was, for the time being, incapable of speech, but found herself wishing with all her heart for a film crew. Except a crew wouldn't help, would it? If you broadcast what she was seeing, the audience would dismiss it as a camera trick. You had to actually be here to believe it. You had to actually see a naked woman floating a foot over her bunk with a cell phone in her hands. You had to see the green tendrils twisting through her black hair.
"Hello there," Evie called cheerily, but without looking around.
The better part of her attention was on the cell phone in her hands.
"I'll be with you in a minute, but right now I've got an important piece of business to finish."
Her fingers on the phone were a blur.
"Jared?"
It was Clint. He sounded both amazed and afraid.
"What are you doing here?"
18. Leading the way, little as he liked it, now, Don Peters had reached the halfway point of the corridor leading to Broadway, when Norcross and an old bearded fellow with red suspenders appeared out of the drifting smoke. Norcross was supporting his companion. Red suspenders was plodding slowly in a hunch. Don guessed he'd been shot, although he couldn't see any blood. "You'll both be shot in a minute," Don thought, and raised his rifle.
30 feet behind him, Drew T. Barry raised his own rifle, although he had no idea what Peters had seen.
The drifting smoke was too thick, and Peters was in the way. Then, as Clint and Willie headed past the booth and down the short A-wing corridor leading to the soft cell, a pair of long white arms reached out of the infirmary and seized Don by the throat. Drew T. Barry watched, amazed, as, like a magic trick, Don vanished. The infirmary door slammed shut. When Barry hurried up to where Peters had been standing and tried the knob, he found the door locked. He peered through the wire-reinforced glass and saw a woman who looked like she might be high on drugs, holding a chisel to Peters' throat. She had stripped away the ridiculous football helmet. It lay overturned on the floor beside his gun.
Peters's thinning black hair was plastered to his skull in sweaty strings.
The woman, an inmate wearing prison browns, saw Barry looking in. She raised her chisel and motioned with it. The gesture was clear enough. Get out of here.
Drew T. Barry considered shooting through the glass, but that would draw any defenders who were left. He also remembered the promise he'd made to himself before shooting the second boogie lady in the gym.
After this, Mr. Prison Guard, you're on your own.
He gave the crazy-looking inmate a little salute, plus a thumbs up for good measure. Then he headed down the corridor. But cautiously. Before being grabbed, Peters had seen something.
19.
Oh, look who I found, said Angel. It's the one who likes to grab girls' tits and twist their nips and rub up against their hinies until he shoots off in his underwear.
When she had lifted her hand to wave off the insurance man, Don had slipped away, putting a little space between them.
Put that chisel down, inmate. Put it down this instant and I won't have to write you up.
That ain't come on your pants this time, Angel observed. Too much of it, even for a jizz hound like you. You wet yourself, didn't you? Mommy wouldn't like that, would she?
At the mention of his sainted mother, Don threw caution to the wind and rushed forward. Angel slashed at him and might have ended things right there had he not stumbled over the football helmet. Instead of cutting his throat, the chisel drew a deep gash across his forehead. Blood sheeted down his face as he went to his knees.
Ow! Ow! Stop it! That hurt!
Yeah, see how this does,
Angel said and kicked him in the stomach. Trying to blink blood out of his eyes, Don grabbed one of Angel's legs and yanked her down. Her elbow struck the floor and jarred the chisel out of her hand. Don wriggled up her body and reached for her throat.
I ain't gonna fuck you after you're dead, he told her. That's nasty. I'll just choke you unconscious. I won't kill you until I'm fit.
Angel grasped the football helmet, swung it in a wide-armed arc, and brought it crashing into Don's bleeding forehead. He rolled off her, clutching at his face.
Ow! No! You stop that, inmate!
That helmet-smashing stuff is also a big penalty in the NFL, Angel thought. But since no one's showing this on TV, I guess I won't lose any yardage. She hit Don with the helmet twice more, perhaps breaking his nose with the second blow. It was certainly bent badly enough. He managed to turn over and get to his knees with his ass sticking up. He was shouting something that sounded like, "Stop it, inmate," but it was hard to tell because the pig was panting so hard. Also, his lips were busted and his mouth was full of blood. It sprayed out with each word, and Angel remembered what they used to say when they were kids. Do you serve towels with your showers?
No more, Don said. Please, no more. You broke my face.
She cast the helmet aside and picked up the chisel.
Here's your titty rub, Officer Peters.
She buried the chisel between his shoulder blades, all the way up to the wooden handle.
Mom!
He cried.
Okay, Officer Peters. Here's one for your ma.
She ripped the chisel out and buried it in his neck, and he collapsed. Angel kicked him a few times, then straddled him and began to stab again. She went on until she could no longer lift her arm. 16. 1. Drew T. Barry reached the booth and saw what had stopped Peters before the woman grabbed him. Two men, one of them possibly Norcross, the arrogant bastard who had instigated this mess. He had his arm around the other one. This was good. They had no idea he was here, and were probably on their way to the woman. To protect her. It was insane, given the size of the force Geary had mustered, but look how much damage they'd managed to inflict already. Good townspeople killed and wounded. They deserved to die just for that. And then, two more came out of the smoke. A woman and a younger man. All with their backs to Drew T. Barry. Better and better. 2.
Jesus Christ, Clint said to his son. You were supposed to be hiding. He looked reproachfully at Michaela. You were supposed to take care of that. Jared replied before Michaela could. She did what you told her, but I couldn't hide. I just couldn't. Not if there's a chance we can get Mom back. And Mary, Molly, too. He pointed to the woman in the cell at the end of the corridor.
Dad, look at her. She's floating. What is she? Is she even human?
Before Clint could answer, a burst of music came from Hicks's phone, followed by the proclamation of a tiny electronic voice.
Congratulations, Player Evie! You have survived! Boomtown is yours!
Evie dropped to her bunk, swung her legs onto the floor, and approached the bars. Clint would have thought he was beyond surprised at this point, but was shocked to see her pubic hair was mostly green. Not hair at all, in fact. It was some kind of vegetation.
I won, she cried happily. And not a minute too soon. I was down to the last 2% of battery. Now I can die happy.
You're not going to die, Clint said. He no longer believed it, though. She was going to die. And when what remained of Geary's force got here, which would be momentarily, it was likely that they were going to die with her. They had killed too many. Frank's men wouldn't stop. 3. Drew T. Barry slid around the side of the booth, liking what he saw more and more. Unless some of the defenders were hiding in the cells, all that remained of Norcross's little cabal was at the end of this corridor, clustered together like pins in a bowling alley. They had no place to hide, and they were all out of running room. Excellent. He raised the Weatherby, and a chisel pressed into his throat, just below the angle of his jaw.
No, 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 Angel said in the voice of a cheery primary school teacher.
Her face, shirt, and baggy pants were stippled with blood.
Move, and I'll cut open your jugular vein. I got the blade right on it. Only reason you're not dead already is you let me finish my business with Officer Peters. Put that elephant gun on the floor. Don't bend. Just drop it.
This is a very valuable weapon, ma'am, said Drew T. Barry.
Ask me if I give a shit.
It might go off.
I'll take that chance.
Drew T. Barry dropped it.
Now hand me the one you've got slung over your shoulder. Don't try anything weird, either.
From behind them, Lady, whatever you're holding on his throat, put it down. Angel snatched a quick look over her shoulder and saw four or five men with their rifles pointed. She smiled at them.
You can shoot me, but this one here will die with me. That's a stone promise.
Frank stood, indecisive. Drew T. Barry, hoping to live a little longer, handed over Don's M4.
Thank you, Angel said, and hooked it over her own shoulder.
She stepped back, dropped the chisel, and raised her hands to either side of her face, showing Frank and the others that they were empty. Then she backed slowly down the short hall to where Clint was standing with his arm still around Willie, supporting him. She kept her hands up the whole way. Drew T. Barry, surprised to be alive, but grateful, picked up his Weatherby. He felt light-headed. He supposed anyone would feel light-headed after having a lunatic female inmate hold a chisel to his throat. She had told him to put the gun down, then let him pick it up again. Why? So she could be on the killing ground with her friends? It seemed the only answer. A crazy one, but she was crazy. They all were. Drew T. Barry decided it was up to Frank Geary to make the next move. He had inaugurated this colossal shitshow, let him figure out how to clean it up. That was best, because to the outside world, what they had done in the last half hour would look a lot like a vigilante action. And there were parts of it, the walking corpses in the gym, for instance,
or the naked green woman he spied standing at the cell bars a few steps behind Norcross, that the outside world would simply not believe. Aurora or no Aurora. Drew T. Barry felt lucky to be alive and would be happy to fade into the background. With luck, the world might never know he'd even been here.
What the fuck?
Said Carson Struthers, who had seen the green woman down the hall.
That ain't right nor normal. What do you want to do with her, Geary?
Take her and take her alive, Frank said. He had never felt so tired in his life, but he would see this through. If she really is the key to Aurora, let the docs figure her out. We'll drive her to Atlanta and hand her over. Willie started to raise his rifle, but slowly, as if it weighed 1,000 pounds. It wasn't hot in A-Wing, but his round face was wet with sweat. It had darkened his beard. Clint grabbed the rifle away from him. At the end of the corridor, Carson Struthers, Treater, Ordway, and Barrows raised their own guns.
That's it, Evie cried. Here we go. Shootout at the OK Corral. Bonnie and Clyde. Die hard in a women's prison.
But before the short A-Wing corridor could become a free-fire zone, Clint dropped Willie's rifle and yanked the M4 from Angel's shoulder. He held it over his head for Frank's group to see. Slowly, and with some reluctance, the men who had raised their guns now lowered them.
No, no, Evie said. People won't pay to see such a poor excuse for a climax. We need a rewrite.
Clint paid no attention. He was focused on Frank. I can't let you take her, Mr. Geary. In an eerily good John Wayne imitation, Evie drawled, If you hurt the little lady, you're going to have to answer to me, you varmint. Frank also ignored her. I appreciate your dedication, Norcross, although I'll be damned if I understand it. Maybe you don't want to, Clint said. Oh, I think I've got the picture, Frank said. You're the one who's not seeing clearly.
Too much shrinky-dink shit in his head, Struthers said, and this brought a few grunts of tense laughter.
Frank spoke patiently, as if lecturing a slow pupil.
So far as we know, she's the only woman on Earth who can sleep and wake up again. Be reasonable. I only want to take her to doctors who can study her, and maybe figure out how to reverse what's happened. These men want their wives and daughters back.
There was a rumble of agreement at this from the invaders.
So stand aside, tenderfoot,
Evie said, still doing the Duke.
I reckon...
Oh, shut up, Michaela said. Evie's eyes flew wide, as if she had been unexpectedly slapped. Michaela stepped forward, fixing Frank with a stare that burned. Do I look sleepy to you, Mr. Geary?
I don't care what you are, said Frank. We're not here for you.
This raised another chorus of agreement. You ought to care. I'm wide awake. So is Angel. She woke us up, breathed into us, and woke us up.
Which is what we want for all the women, Frank said, and this brought a louder chorus of agreement.
The impatience that Michaela read on the faces of the men gathered before her was close to hate.
If you're really awake, you should get that. It's not rocket science.
You don't get it, Mr. Geary. She was able to do that because Angel and I weren't in cocoons. Your wives and daughters are. That's not rocket science either. Silence. She finally had their attention, and Clint allowed himself to hope. Carson Struthers spoke one flat word.
Bullshit.
Michaela shook her head.
You stupid, willful man. All of you stupid and willful. Evie Black isn't a woman. She's a supernatural being. Don't you understand that yet, after all that's happened? Do you think doctors can take DNA from a supernatural being, put her in an MRI tube, and figure out how she ticks? All the men who have died here, it was for nothing.
Pete Ordway raised a Garand rifle.
I could put a bullet in you, ma'am, and stop your mouth. Tempted to do it. Put it down, Pete.
Frank could feel this thing dancing on the edge of control. Here were men with guns faced with a seemingly insoluble problem. To them, the easiest way to deal with it would be to shoot it to pieces. He knew this because he felt it himself.
Norcross, have your people stand aside. I want a good look at her.
Clint stepped back, one arm around Willie Burke to hold him up, and one hand laced through Jared's fingers. Michaela flanked Jared on the other side. Angel stood defiantly in front of the soft cell for a moment, shielding Evie with her body. But when Michaela took her hand and pulled gently, Angel gave in and stood beside her.
"Better not hurt her," Angel said.
Her voice was trembling. Tears stood in her eyes.
"Just better not, you bastards. She's a fucking goddess."
Frank took three steps forward, not knowing or caring if his remaining men followed. He looked at Evie so long and hard that Clint turned to look himself. The greenery that had twined in her hair was gone. Her naked body was beautiful, but in no way extraordinary. Her pubic hair was a dark triangle above the joining of her thighs.
"What the fuck?" Carson Struthers said. "Wasn't she just green?"
"It's nice to finally make your acquaintance in person, ma'am," Frank said.
"Thank you," said Evie. Bold nakedness notwithstanding, she sounded as shy as a schoolgirl. Her eyes were downcast. "Do you like it, Frank, putting animals in cages?"
"I only cage those that need to be caged," said Frank,
and for the first time in days, he really smiled. If there was one thing he knew, it was that wild went two ways. The danger a wild animal presented to others, and the danger that others presented to a wild animal. In general, he cared more about keeping the animals safe from the people.
"And I've come to let you out of yours. I want to take you to doctors who can examine you. Would you allow me to do that?"
"I think not," Evie said. "They would find nothing and change nothing. Remember the story of the golden goose? When the men cut it open, there was nothing inside but guts." Frank sighed and shook his head. He doesn't believe her because he doesn't want to believe her, Clint thought, because he can't afford to believe her. Not after all he's done.
"Ma'am?"
"Why don't you call me Evie?" she said. "I don't like this formality. I thought we had a lovely little rapport when we talked on the phone, Frank." But her eyes were still downcast. Clint wondered what was in them that she had to hide. Doubt about her mission here? That was probably wishful thinking, but possible. Hadn't Jesus Christ himself prayed to have the cup taken from his lips? As, he supposed, Frank wished that scientists at the CDC would take the cup from his. That they would look at Evie's scans and blood work and DNA and say, "Aha!"
"Evie it is," Frank said.
"This inmate..." He tilted his head toward Angel, who was staring at him with wrath.
"She says that you're a goddess. Is that true?"
"No," Evie said. At Clint's side, Willie began to cough and rub the left side of his chest.
"This other woman..." This time the tilt went toward Michaela. "She says you're a supernatural being. And..."
Frank didn't like to say it aloud, to get close to the fury that it could lead to, but he had to.
"You knew things about me that you couldn't have known."
"Plus she can float," Jared blurted. "You may have noticed that. She levitated. I saw it. We all did."
Evie looked at Michaela. "You're wrong about me, you know. I am a woman, and in most ways like any other. Like the ones these men love. Although love is a dangerous word when it comes from men. Quite often they don't mean the same thing as women do when they say it. Sometimes they mean they'll kill for it. Sometimes when they say it, they don't mean much of anything. Which, of course, most women come to know. Some with resignation, many with sorrow."
"When a man says he loves you, that means he wants to get his pecker up inside your pants,"
Angel put in helpfully.
Evie returned her attention to Frank and the men standing behind him. The women you want to save are at this very moment living their lives in another place. Happy lives, by and large, although of course most miss their little boys and some miss their husbands and fathers. I won't say they never behave badly, they are far from saints, but for the most part, they're in harmony. In that world, Frank, no one ever pulls your daughter's favorite shirt, shouts in her face, embarrasses her, or terrifies her by putting his fist through the wall. They're alive? Carson Struthers asked. Do you swear it, woman? Do you swear to God? Yes, Evie said. I swear to your God and every God. How do we get them back, then? Not by poking me or prodding me or taking my blood. Those things wouldn't work, even if I were to allow them. What will? Evie spread her arms wide. Her eyes flickered, the pupils expanding to black diamonds, the irises roiling from pale green to brilliant amber, turning to cat's eyes. Kill me, she said. Kill me and they'll awake. Every woman on earth. I swear this is true. Like a man in a dream, Frank raised his rifle. 4. Clint stepped in front of Evie.
No, Dad, no!
Jared screamed. Clint took no notice. She's lying, Geary. She wants you to kill her. Not all of her. I think part of her has changed her mind, but it's what she came here to do. What she was sent here to do. Next you'll be saying she wants to be hung on a cross, Pete Ordway said. Stand aside, Doc. Clint didn't. It's a test. If we pass it, there's a chance. If we don't, if you do what she expects you to do, the door closes. This will be a world of men until all the men are gone. He thought of the fights he'd had growing up, battling not for milkshakes, not really, but just for a little sun and space, a little room to fucking breathe, to grow. He thought of Shannon, his old friend, who had depended on him to pull her out of that purgatory as much as he had depended on her. He had done so to the best of his ability, and she had remembered. Why else would she have given her daughter his last name? But he still owed a debt. To Shannon, for being a friend. To Lila, for being a friend, and his wife, and his son's mother. And those who were with him, here in front of Evie's cell, they also had women to whom they owed debts. Yes, even Angel. It was time to pay off. The fight he'd wanted was over. Clint was punched out, and he hadn't won a thing. Not yet. He held his hands out to either side, palms up, and beckoned. Evie's last defenders came and stood in a line in front of her cell. Even Willie, who appeared on the verge of passing out. Jared stood next to Clint, and Clint put a hand on his son's neck. Then, very slowly, he picked up the M4. He handed it to Michaela, whose mother slept in a cocoon not far from where they now stood. Listen to me, Frank. Evie's told us that if you don't kill her, if you just let her go, there's a chance the women can come back. He's lying, Evie said. But now that he couldn't see her, Frank heard something in her voice that gave him pause. It sounded like anguish. Enough bullshit, Pete Ordway said and spat on the floor. We lost a lot of good men getting this far. Let's just take her. We can decide what comes next later. Clint lifted Willie's rifle. He did so reluctantly, but he did it. Michaela turned to Evie. Whoever sent you here thinks this is how men solve all their problems. Isn't that right? Evie made no reply. Michaela had an idea that the remarkable creature in the soft cell was being torn in ways she had never expected when she appeared in the woods above that rusted trailer. She turned back to the armed men, now halfway down the corridor. Their guns were pointed. At this range, their bullets would shred the little group in front of the strange woman. Michaela raised her weapon.
It doesn't have to go this way. Show her it doesn't have to.
Which means doing what?
Frank asked.
It means letting her go back to where she came from, Clint said.
Not on your life, said Drew T. Barry. And that was when Willie Burke's knees buckled and he went down, no longer breathing. 5.
Frank handed his rifle to Ordway. He needs CPR. I took the course last summer.
Clint pointed his rifle at Frank's chest.
No.
Frank stared at him. Man, are you crazy?
Step back, Michaela said, pointing her own gun at Frank. She didn't know what Clint was doing, but she had an idea he was playing the last card in his hand.
In our hand, she thought.
Let's shoot them all, Carson Struthers said. He sounded near hysterics.
That devil woman, too.
Stand down, Frank said. And to Clint, you're just going to let him die? What would that prove?
Evie can save him, Clint said.
Can't you, Evie?
The woman in the cell said nothing. Her head was lowered, her hair obscuring her face.
Geary, if she saves him, will you let her go?
That old cocksucker's faking, Carson Struthers shouted. It's all a setup they planned.
Frank began.
Can I just check if...
Okay, yes, Clint said. But be quick. Brain damage starts after 3 minutes, and I don't know if even a supernatural being could reverse that. Frank hurried to Willie, dropped to one knee, and put his fingers to the old man's throat. He looked up at Clint.
His clock's stopped. I should start CPR.
A minute ago, you were ready to kill him, Reed Barrows grumbled. Officer Treat, who thought he had witnessed some shit in Afghanistan, groaned.
I don't understand any of this. Just tell me what it's going to take to get my kid back, and I'll do it.
To whom exactly this statement was directed was unclear. No CPR. Clint turned to Evie, who stood with her head down, which he thought was good because she couldn't help seeing the man on the floor.
This is Willie Burke, said Clint. His country told him to serve, and he served. These days, he goes out with the volunteer fire department to fight brush fires in the spring. They do it without pay. He helps at every bean supper the Ladies' Aid puts on for indigent families the state is too chintzy to support. He coaches Pop Warner football in the fall.
He was a good coach, too,
Jared said. His voice was thick with tears. Clint continued. He took care of his sister for 10 years when she was diagnosed with early-onset Alzheimer's. He fed her. He brought her back when she took it into her head to wander. He changed her shitty diapers. He came out here to defend you because he wanted to do the right thing by you and by his conscience. He never hurt a woman in his life. Now he's dying. Maybe you'll let him. After all, he's just another man, right? Someone was coughing on the smoke drifting down Broadway. For a moment, there was no other sound. Then Evie Black shrieked. Lights burst in their overhead cages. Cell doors that had been locked slammed open and then banged shut in a sound that was like iron hands applauding. Several of the men in Frank's group screamed, one of them in a pitch so high that he sounded like a little girl of 6 or 7. Ordway turned and ran. His footfalls echoed through the cinderblock halls.
Pick him up, Evie said.
Her cell door had opened with the others. If, that was, it had ever been locked in the first place. Clint had no doubt that she could have left whenever she wished at any time during the last week. The rats had only been part of her theater. Clint and Jared Norcross lifted Willie's limp form. He was heavy, but Evie took him as if he were no more than a bag of goose feathers.
You played on my heart, she said to Clint. That was a cruel thing to do, Dr. Norcross. Her face was solemn, but he thought that he saw a glint of amusement in her eyes, maybe even merriment.
She encircled Willie's considerable waistline with her left arm and placed her right hand on the matted, sweat-soaked hair at the back of the old man's head. Then she pressed her mouth to his. Willie shuddered all over.
His arm is lifted to encircle Evie's back. For a moment, the old man and the young woman remained in a deep embrace. Then she let him go and stood back.
How do you feel, Willie?
Damn good, Willie Burke said.
He sat up.
My God, Reed Barrows said. He looks 20 years younger.
I ain't been kissed like that since I was in high school, said Willie.
If ever.
Ma'am, I think you saved my life.
I thank you for that, but I think the kiss was even better.
Evie began to smile.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I rather liked it myself, although it wasn't as good as beating Boomtown. Clint's blood was no longer up. Exhaustion and Evie's latest miracle had cooled it. He looked on the rage he had felt so recently like a man looking at a stranger who has broken into his house and cluttered the kitchen while making himself an extravagant and gluttonous breakfast. He felt sad and regretful and terribly tired. He wished he could just go home, sit beside his wife, share space with her, and not have to say a word.
Geary, Clint said. Frank was slow to look at him, like a man shaking off a daze. Let her go. It's the only way.
Maybe, but even that's not sure, is it?
No, Clint agreed. What in this fucked up life is?
Angel spoke up then.
Bad times and good times, she said. Bad times and good. All the rest is just horse shit in the barn.
I thought it would take at least until Thursday, but... Evie laughed, a sound like tinkling bells. I forgot how fast men can move when they set their minds to a thing.
Sure, Michaela said. Just think of the Manhattan Project.
6. At 8:10 on that fine morning, a line of 6 vehicles drove down West Lavin Road, while behind them the prison smoldered like a discarded cigar butt in an ashtray. They turned onto Balls Hill Road. Unit 2 led the way with its flashers turning slowly. Frank was behind the wheel. Clint was in the shotgun seat. Behind them sat Evie Black, exactly where she had been sitting after Lila arrested her. Then she had been half-naked. On this return trip, she was wearing a dueling correctional red top.
How we're ever going to explain this to the state police, I don't know, Frank said. Lot of men dead. Lot of men wounded.
Right now, everyone's got their hands full with Aurora, Clint said. And probably half of them aren't even showing up. When all the women come back... If they come back, no one will care.
From behind them, Evie spoke quietly.
The mothers will.
The wives. The daughters.
Who do you think cleans up the battlefields after the shooting stops?
7. Unit 2 stopped in the lane leading to Truman Mayweather's trailer, where yellow crime scene tape still fluttered. The other vehicles, 2 more police cruisers, 2 civilian cars, and Carson Struthers' pickup truck pulled up behind them.
Now what? Clint asked.
Now we'll see, Evie said. If one of these men doesn't change his mind and shoot me after all, that is.
That won't happen, Clint replied, not nearly as confident as he sounded. Doors slammed. For the moment, the trio in Unit 2 sat where they were.
Tell me something, Evie, Frank said. If you're just the emissary, who's in charge of this rodeo? Some, I don't know, life force? Big Mama Earth, maybe, hitting the reset button?
Do you mean the great lesbian in the sky? Evie asked. A short, heavy-set deity wearing a mauve pantsuit and sensible shoes. Isn't that the image most men get when they think a woman is trying to run their lives?
I don't know.
Frank felt listless, done up. He missed his daughter. He even missed Elaine. He didn't know what had happened to his anger. It was like his pocket had torn, and it had fallen out somewhere along the way.
What comes to mind when you think about men, smartass?
Guns, she said.
Clint, there appear to be no door handles back here.
Don't let that stop you, he said.
She didn't.
One of the back doors opened, and Evie Black stepped out. Clint and Frank joined her, one on each side, and Clint was reminded of the Bible classes he'd been forced to attend at one foster home or another. Jesus on the cross, with the disbelieving bad guy on one side,